Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 311, recorded on Monday, August 21st, 2017. Andreas Weigand. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life, and that's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Hello, welcome to Triangulation. This is the show where we talk about technology with some of the biggest movers, shakers, people talking about technology in the sphere. I'm Jason Howell, and I have the pleasure of sitting down here with Andreas Weigand, author of Data for the People, which is the book that I've been poring over for quite a while now. It's a fantastic book. Also founder and director of the Social Data Lab. Formerly, you were chief scientist at Amazon, which we'll definitely get into because I'm sure that was a fascinating foundation for the book. And also, you have a PhD in physics at Stanford, artificial intelligence, machine learning. I mean, all of this stuff is so top of mind right now. Anyways, it's really great to sit down with you today.
Great to be here, Jason.
Thank you for joining us. So, I feel like the last couple of years, when we're talking about artificial intelligence and we're talking about big data and neural networks and how it's all colliding right now, I feel like, yes, these are terms and these are concepts that we've been talking about for a very long time, but I feel like right now at this point in time is an inflection point where things are really shifting in a major way, and we're starting to learn how this new world order works with access to such incredible tools like these. What do you think about that?
I absolutely agree. It is the point where several things come together in history, that we have enormous data sets because whatever we do, we create data about our actions. Mm-hmm. We have enormous tool sets, compute power, that allows us to analyze this data. We have more and more of the skill sets that people are able to actually come up with predictions, with insights from this data. So what's left? What is this decision point? It's a question of mindset. Are we going to have the mindset to use the data that we create for the people? Or is there a mindset that, if in doubt, we'll use it against the people for the industrial military complex? So that is why I wrote the book. I want the data to be used for the people. And that's what we're going to talk about.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, that's a big ask, right, of companies that have such access to such detailed information about how we live our lives. I have to imagine, like, they, you know, it's part of their competitive advantage to keep that information as tight to the chest as possible. There's just so much of it. Big data, I mean, is so big it's almost inconceivable. So it's in some ways, as I was reading through the book, in some ways it's hard for me to understand how the companies who are collecting, harvesting, managing all this data to create their competitive advantage, how we find ourselves in a place where they are willing to let go of that control a little bit, or at least open it up so that people on the other end whose data is being shared with them are, you know, can have access and manipulate that data on their own.
You're absolutely right. It's not the size that matters. It's what you do with it. The motion of the ocean, as you say.
So what drives your fascination with big data? Is it just, I mean, you've been involved, like I said, you were formerly a chief scientist at Amazon. And Amazon, when you think of big data, like, there aren't many companies that are much bigger than Amazon as far as putting all of that data that it's harvesting around users to play, you know, as far as what products are suggested, what people, you know, what people's fascinations and interests actually are based on their buying patterns, all that kind of stuff. What fascinated you about this to begin with?
I've always been interested in the data people create. How the data we create can help us make better decisions, better for ourselves. So in the 80s, when I was in college, I was very interested in psychological tests. What can we learn about people? Then also, I was very fortunate that in the 80s, I did my undergraduate thesis at CERN in Geneva. And that was a time when the beginning of the web was to be seen. So that notion that we can use data to collaborate, to work together on problems too big for any individual to solve, that sort of was really what got me excited. I then went to Stanford to do my PhD, and initially I wanted to do it at Slack at the Stanford Linux Accelerator Center, because that's where they had the largest amounts of data and the biggest computers outside the defense. And then David Rummelhart, one of the people who invented neural networks, he came to Stanford. And he was in the psychology department. And he really was one of the people who best knew how to understand people through the data they create. And neural networks is a way of formalizing this, of coming up with algorithms that learn from data. The time hadn't quite come yet because we didn't really have all that much data that people create in everyday lives. Think about this. In the 80s, there were no mobile phones. So we didn't know the geolocation of people. And even there was no web at that stage, so we didn't know what people clicked on. We had very little insight into the decision-making process of people. But we saw it coming. And so for me, it was just absolutely wonderful to be able to do my thesis with him on building neural networks for prediction, for time series prediction. And then after my thesis, Wall Street was very interested in whether that emerging technology in neural networks could be used in some way. So I sold all my consulting time 1 year for Goldman, then JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley. And it was pretty amazing how Wall Street was one of the early adapters of technologies because they had data. And this specifically D.E. Shaw, David Shaw, was, I think, one of the pioneers who realized that whoever has the better data will have the better results. And then after looking at the traces traders left on Wall Street, then the opportunity came along that Amazon called, Headhunter called, asked whether they wanted to be Jeff's chief scientist. And as the chief scientist at Amazon, we could also look, of course, not only the traces traders leave in the world, but the traces people leave in the decision-making process when they buy things. And then after Amazon, I've worked with a number of companies on geolocation data, on data which people create even outside the shopping process, outside the web. And the deep questions that has is, in this world where a billion people think about themselves differently from before, think Facebook, where a billion people think about knowledge differently from before, think Google, and of course where billion people think about buying things differently from before, think Amazon, Alibaba. What does the future look like? How can we build a future based on those data that actually helps us and doesn't hurt us? Health insurance is one of the examples where that will, I think, be very, very apparent very soon.
Well, yes, health insurance could be beneficial from embracing the large amounts of information that can be shared about a person. I think it's also, you know, one of the examples that people might use as saying this is a bad idea, right? Because I don't want my insurance company to know all of this information. That's opening things up just a little too wide for them. What do you say? What do you say about that?
I have a very clear opinion on that, which is nostalgia isn't the way it used to be. Meaning that we can't turn back to a past which was actually not that great. If you think about health, 100 years ago wasn't what it is now.
Sure.
So let's embrace the fact that we are creating those data. Let's embrace the fact that getting my DNA sequenced is $100 and figure out what can we do with it, as opposed to trying to prevent people from analyzing data. The saliva added on this mug is enough for you to find out elements of my DNA. So I think the message I have is don't try to fight the battle of the past. Focus on the battle, which is the current battle, which is getting companies to actually give stuff to us, to refine our data in a way that benefits us as well as them, but not only them on our expense.
Do you think 25, 30 years ago we could have envisioned today then? Like, obviously, you were talking about back in the 80s, you know, taking a look at, you know, Wall Street is one example, Wall Street benefiting from all that data because there were data points there. And we've gotten to a point, I feel like, right now where companies are doing really fascinating, helpful things for consumers. Is that something that we could have determined back then? And could we have put some of these practices in place back then to make sure we were better prepared today?
Probably not. I think predictions are hard, particularly those concerning the future.
Yeah.
So I think it is driving, being alert. And for me, data literacy is as important as text literacy. Mm-hmm. So if you think about how much time is spent in schools to have people learn reading and writing, and how little time is spent to get people data literate. What we have seen in Europe in the 1700s, 1800s, that the power of being able to read, think Martin Luther, think about how the world has changed. Enlightenment wouldn't have been possible without people being able to read. Mm-hmm. What even the Catholic Church in the 60s realized, that having people preach in Latin to people who don't understand Latin isn't really the most effective way of getting people on board. That is happening right now with the data revolution, which we see. And I really want enlightening to be happening in how we relate to our data and what we can ask for it. It is not that it should be done in Latin, but it should be that we all have the skill to read our data. And for companies, let's say Google or Facebook, that means that they don't have just by some legalese, I have read and understood the 22 pages, which is Ask Me and a Billion People to Lie, which I hate.
Yes.
But it is helping consumers through tools to understand their data, mm-hmm. helping them compare their behavior to others, as Google Dashboard, for instance, does a very good job in helping me understand my geolocation and allowing me to every now and then to edit a point if I don't want that to be available for posterity. But then to understand that if I edit out, it is gone. As opposed to, gee, you know, I didn't want it to be seen, but now where was I that day? Well, dude, that's gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so early on, it's very early in the book. It's within the first couple of pages, actually. You kind of highlight a scenario which really kind of indicates the depth and the breadth of data collection. You talk about like a day in the life, essentially. The moment you wake up, the signal that your garage door gives when you leave the house, and all of this information kind of spilling out there. And I think you're right. I think by and large, people don't understand. Like, on one hand, we understand that smartphones, as one example, brings to our lives a whole series of conveniences, but don't necessarily look at the flip side of that, which is, well, what is that based on? What is driving those conveniences, and how is that translated to the companies? And then what are they doing with it? And I think the big point, obviously, in Data for the People is, okay, they're doing this stuff with your data, but how can you get in on it too? And how can you have some sort of control over that, at least? But you're not talking full control, or are you talking full control?
No, there is no such thing as full control. But I'm asking for having a seat at the controls. So let me give you an example. If you want to have music recommendations, then if you had a little knob where you can share with the recommendation engine whether today you are stressed out and you want just really smooth stuff and no surprises, or it's a sketchy date and you really want nothing to interfere with, you know, what you might want to get out of it, or are you in very explorative mood and you want to just discover new stuff. So you want to have a slider which you can set from, you know, what I always have here to actually surprise me with stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's an example of one of these controls. Don't have the refinery guess what is the right thing for me if I have an opinion, but make it easy for me to set that control.
Oh, man. I mean, companies right now love feeling like they know what you want before you want it. You know what I mean? It seems like a lot of these companies, that's a big foundation around what they're working towards with access to this data is, hey, we know enough about you that we can tell you what you want before you want it. Do you think that, in my personal experience, it's about 50-50. You know, half the time it gets it right. The other half, when it doesn't, I feel like it's a waste of time.
So I think as a physicist, I like thought experiments. So let's actually take that one seriously. And let's assume that really, let's say, take a dating site, that everybody who that site recommends to you, you fall in love with instantaneously. You think that's the one for your life. How would you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, on one hand, this is what we think that's a modern convenience that we would think of being empowered by data to the point where it would know so much about me that it could do that. Wouldn't that be convenient, right? If I was in the market, let's say, or looking for a product or looking for a companion or whatever, to be given the right match. But at the same time, you really have to kind of ask yourself what kind of data is driving that decision. And if that's a decision that could be reached with 100% accuracy, what does that say about their capabilities on the other side?
Yeah. So, but assume it was 100% accurate, that maybe you have to set the switch between Mr. Right and Mr. Right Now. So there might be a couple of parameters, but then, you know, I would love to use a service like that. Mm-hmm. But some people might feel that their free will is given up.
Right.
But we're very good in the illusion of being good in making decisions. In most cases, many of the clinical studies have shown that if the data is around, computers actually are better than us to make the decisions. So the skills that served us well for the first few thousand years as humans might not serve us all that well anymore compared to the rich data and AI companions, which we can work with now for some important questions in life.
Mm-hmm. You make a comparison with data to being the new oil. And comparison that I've heard in the past is that data is the new currency. Data is all this. Can you explain a little bit why the comparison to oil?
Yeah.
And how it's different, especially because, I mean, there are some similarities. There are also some very big differences.
So it was at a meeting in Palo Alto when I asked some friends at a coffee shop, what title should I give a talk I was invited to give to the General Assembly of the United Nations? And one of them suggested data is the new oil, and I thought it was just an awesome title. Of course, 5 minutes later, I looked on the web, and if not, 100,000 people had used the same title. But, you know, I do remember that meeting, and it is a good metaphor because oil needs to be refined for the value to actually be extracted. Mm-hmm. Similarly, raw data needs to be refined for the value to be extracted. And the value of data for me is helping people make better decisions. Now, there are huge differences. Oil is a finite resource, and in some ways, it's a win-lose game. Data is not a finite resource. It's growing exponentially. And in that sense, it's a win-win game. So if I give you access to a data point I have and you give me access to a data point you have, we both have access to the data points. Versus if I give you my oil and you give me your oil, we still have no more oil than we had before. Mm-hmm. So that really powers that amazing economy we live in. I call it the post-privacy economy, where we take the loss of privacy as a given. As I said before, that would be the wrong tree to bark upon. But then we ask, what economic value can we create out of it?
Yeah, what is the trade-off for all that collected data? There's certainly
absolutely.
There's certainly risks, but there's also
and it all is about trade-offs. Don't believe people who paint the world in black and white. Mm-hmm. I think throughout the book, I want people to become aware of the trade-offs they have, and I think one way of dealing with it is to write all these terms in an equation, and then decide on the weights you have. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, if you have more of that, you have less of that. I mean, you know the standard example that you can't have cheap, fast, and good. Pick two out of three mm-hmm. or find your way in the triangle. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very important, and that's how data ethics starts for me, to say at least start with a consistency picture where you avoid inconsistencies. So don't ask for things where you could know that if you ask for it, there will be consequences which you don't want afterwards. Mm-hmm. So I want people, part of data literacy for me means to know what the consequences of the decisions are which we're making now, both for ourselves, but probably also for others.
Where does data literacy come from? I mean, like, I've thought about this in terms of like financial education as well, right? Like, of all the things in our lives that are so incredibly important, when you take a look at finance, we get very little education about that as kids growing up, going through school. Like, unless that's a specialization that you want to take, you don't really hit adulthood and have very good, well-formed thought around that unless your parents, you know, bring you into that or you learn it from your family. Same would go for data, right? Where does that education come from, do you think?
Okay. So I don't think it is the same. I think if you look at who were the people who got rich in society, let's go back to the high priests in Egypt. They forecasted, for instance, the floods of the Nile. Long time horizon, very noisy output. Because, hey, if they didn't come that year, I mean, we all know that, you know, predictions can't be that good. Mm-hmm. To the Middle Ages, those quacksalver doctors, people who told you about bloodletting or about whatever happens after death. Long time horizon, also quite noisy. Also, the feedback loops weren't all that clear whether people really got what they were promised after death. Mm. And I think financial advisors fall exactly into the same position. Long feedback cycles and noisy outputs. Everyone knows you can't really predict what's going on. So just hang in with me. Sorry we had another bad year, Andreas. But, you know, I'm sure next will be much better for you. And, you know, here's, of course, the fixed sum of your assets which you pay to me for my services. So I think that model is a model which is pre-data, where people push whatever their boss tells them. Mm-hmm. But then there are companies now. An example is Mike Schar's SIGFIG, standing for significant figures, where you give your username and password to your brokerage to that company, and now they log into your account and they check how your performance is. And they also log, of course, into the account of other SIGFIG customers. And what I love is that the transparency they can create now gives you a weapon to go to your financial advisor and say, are you aware that you did in the 20th percentile of the performance of last year when we take everybody else at your brokerage? Do you really think that you want me to pay you the full fee? So I love it when data is created and the authorities, or in this case the financial institution, can't do anything but admit defeat. You know, I have a house in China, and the air quality is not always very good. And it used to be that the Chinese government published the figures about the wonderful air quality. But in the cities where there were U.S. consulates, you know, somehow near the U.S. consulates, the air quality seemed much worse than the ones that the Chinese government published. And then some do-it-yourself kits came out, and some technology similar to what we have when you access the dark web using Tor, what we have here, so they can't be tracked back. And it turned out that those kits all produced very similar measurements as the American propaganda did. And then suddenly the Chinese had to backpedal. And somehow now the numbers pretty much agree between the Chinese government and the US government's number for the air pollution in China. So those are the things which I love, where you can't do anything, where you create data as you go along, and then creating transparency, helping make people, first of all, being honest, and then secondly, helping people make better decisions. In this case, it might be, am I going out today or staying in because the air quality is so bad?
Who doesn't benefit in that scenario? Like I mean, that, like you say, it requires someone to be very literate, data literate. they have to know that they have the ability to do that and that they have those tools to begin with. But who, I mean, the data illiterate, what happens?
I think everybody in China knows that PM2.5 number. So you know how to interpret that number.
Yeah.
Like here we know how to interpret probability of rain, whether we take an umbrella or not. And that is just at the end. I think order of magnitude is another good question, that many people don't know what's possible, what's plausible, what's implausible, or what's just simply impossible.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, data literacy allows people to do these back of the envelope calculations and then just figure out whether something they need to worry about or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting that you're bringing up kind of what's going on in China, because I think to a certain degree, China is kind of moving into this next world when it comes to analysis of big data, machine learning around that, governing their citizens based on that information. There's the social credit system that's kind of in the works right now. What do you think about that? Is that an inevitable direction for the rest of the world, ultimately, but based on where we're at right now?
Yeah. So maybe say a couple of words about the social credit system. If somebody wants to know more, Josh Chin, who writes for the Wall Street Journal in Beijing, has written an absolutely marvelous article about a year ago in the journal. And all I can do here is just summarize a few of these brilliant thoughts he had. So what is to be said for the Chinese government is that they actually are writing down an equation. So it's not shooting off the hips like, you know, president of some countries might be doing here, but it is very much an engineering approach, a decision theoretic approach, that we say we want to have an equation and that equation applies to everybody as rule of law, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's interesting what goes into that equation. For instance, you jaywalk, minus 1 point. You shoplift, minus 5 points. You sell counterfeit goods on Alibaba, plus 100 points, because you clearly show that you understand how the system works and you are an active member of the system.
I didn't know about that part.
To the question about what does this score determine? Well, at Beijing Capital Airport, there are some VIP lines. And if your score is above a certain value, you can go through that VIP line, which of course means that every Chinese checks their score all the time because maybe they might qualify for something. But what's much more worrisome than the positive is for me the negative. If your score is below a certain value, your child might not get into that school which you wanted to go to, mm-hmm. so it has a chance to go to university down the road.
Yep.
So to summarize here, the Chinese have done a very principled approach of giving a number to everybody. By the way, Dark Mirror, season 3, I think.
Yeah, Black Mirror, that's what I was just pulling up, season 3 episode. That is, I mean, is it the first episode,
season? It's an amazing episode.
And it is exactly this.
I would actually love to meet the Black Mirror people. If anybody, you know, has any connection here, maybe any of your listeners, I think it would be awesome if I got connected to them. These people are so visionary. So that is reality in China.
And possibly a model for other places, which when you hear about it now, you're like, wow, well, that's just going too far. But
no,
I mean, if
no,
our lives
think,
are lived and molded around big data, that seems inevitable, right?
What is important is that we make the implicit explicit. So let's take, for instance, if you need a liver transplant, how should the next liver be allocated? Should it be whoever bribes the most?
Mm-hmm.
Probably not. We feel kind of bad about that. So in the US, there is a MELD score, a score the Mayo Clinic developed a few years ago, where it looks at many, many variables and weighs them. So these were smart people who didn't have a direct stake into that. None of them was waiting for a liver transplant, who came up with what they thought is a good way of sorting, of ranking, of giving a score to people. So when the next liver arrives, it's clear about who is giving it, given it won't have an immune rejection and so on and so forth. So I think it's a very good approach to try to capture the things, and the conversation we should have in society is precisely on the level of the weights. Give you another example, education. I love teaching at Berkeley. So I think it is a privilege to get every year 50 students who actually are interested in what I have to say. Nobody forces them to be in class. Mm-hmm. That's just awesome. Mm-hmm. And teaching education is a scarce resource. We can't have everybody taking the classes which they want. How should we allocate it? Those are questions which we as society have to grapple with. We are talking about healthcare. So there are many, many, many questions where by making the implicit explicit, by writing down an equation, we lift the conversation to another level, and that is the level where we should have the conversation in, not on the level of individual instances.
Yeah, I mean, another prime example, of course, is the autonomous vehicles, and two cars are about to get into an accident and it's unavoidable. Do you hit the, you know, does what, which driver is the one that survives and which one is sacrificed? And that, I mean, that all revolves also around kind of the ethical considerations around how you build up these systems to analyze that data. Like how do you make a determination to say one person deserves to live and one person deserves to die? But that needs to happen for that system to exist.
Or another example here is insurance. Well, is the answer to insurance data lobotomy? You can say in the past we didn't know, you know, certain risks you have. We couldn't measure them. So insurance is about pooling risk, and that was fair. Mm-hmm. Now we could know your risks, but we don't want to know the risks. So we just, you know, try to hide those data. Bad news for you. Somebody will get to that data.
Right.
So this data lobotomy that some people are proposing is not the solution. Having a discussion about how do we deal with the data sources. If you had all the data in the world readily available at your fingertips, what would you do? What would you consider fair? Mm-hmm. That, I think, is the important discussion which we need to have as society at this crossroads which we're currently at.
Right. So you've written in the book, Data for the People, you wrote out kind of a Bill of Rights, a data Bill of Rights. And we're going to talk about that here in a second. We do need to thank a sponsor here real quick. We're going to take a moment to thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. They're the sponsor of this episode. Rocket Mortgage is all about taking, we're so used to living our lives in the digital space, online, everything's super convenient that way, but the mortgage process didn't quite keep up with that. And that's what Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans is all about. The old process was dated. It needed a new kind of client-focused technological revolution. And that's where Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or even refinancing your existing home loan, if you like. It's simple. It allows you to fully understand all of the details and be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient. They have trusted partners that allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. They make it super easy so you don't have to go digging through that stack of paperwork to find the information. It's powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds. It's taken all that information based on your income, your assets, your credit. Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of that and all of the home loan options for which you qualify based on that, and then find the one that's just right for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. That's rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of triangulation. So the data Bill of Rights is kind of, that's kind of what this all leads to, right? It's the book really sets the stage for illustrating the many ways the sensory overload, the social connections that we make, all of these just ways that our information, our data is being stored, shared, and yet as users, we're giving so much, yet we have no control over them. So you've listed in the book the Data Bill of Rights to support that, to ensure rights for the people around their data. At a macro level, explain that a little bit at the macro level, I guess, before we dive in.
So I think that the gap between technology and law is widening. Technology is exponentially evolving. Law is not. So what I tried with these two groups of rights I have was to bridge that gap or to bring the two a little bit closer together again. Mm-hmm. And very roughly on the macro level, as you requested, we can say there are two transparency rights, namely the right that you can see your data and the right that you can see what the refineries do. Mm-hmm. And there are four what are called action rights, which means that you have some right to do something with the data, including the right to take your data elsewhere, to not have them locked into one refinery, but to be able to take them. And actually on that note, I'm not sure whether you saw last week the LinkedIn high five case where LinkedIn was told by the court that they need to open up the data people create for other refineries to actually create products out of, because that was deemed to be the right thing as you put data in, as opposed to block other refineries. Mm-hmm. So very much in sort of my vision of the world is that, you know, we create those data and we want a competition of refineries try to create value out of us, and then we want to pick the one which is the most value for us, not being manipulated what should be the most value for us. As sadly, I got a new computer, and rather than staying on Windows 7, I moved to Windows 10. It is sad to see in how many examples Microsoft really tries to push you to do Microsoft things without really having thought it through. I'm happy to give my life into the hands of a Microsoft, but then please be consistent and don't create inconsistent assumptions.
Right. And I feel like we've heard about that about Microsoft. Microsoft's not alone in that complaint, but time and time again. So the first in the data bill of rights, of course, is right to access the data, which we've been talking about a lot right now. We already have access to some of that data, but like we said earlier, you're not proposing that they give us access to everything, because that takes away competitive advantage. They wouldn't be willing to do that, I wouldn't imagine.
It's less about that. It is much more that I believe to really get value out of my data, I need to have tools that allow me to look at my data. So if you have medical data, you tend to go to a doctor or at least run a program that analyzes data for you and shows you what potential actions you take. Mm-hmm. Similarly, if I just have my raw data as zeros and ones, there is nothing I can get out of it. So what I want is companies not to take the trivial route out and say, okay, here is a dump of your data, be my guest, mm-hmm. because there's nothing I can do with it. But to put some resources behind, and I'm not talking custom programming here, it's just, as Google Dashboard does it well, to put some resources behind and let me play with my data. Let me form a mental model of who I actually am. For instance, your favorite dating site, if they allowed me to see that, you know, nobody who I hit up at 3 or 4 in the morning actually turns out to be a happy experience meeting the next day, or the same night, if you will, then maybe I should just simply get that information as I'm doing it. And the other day, I was in Patpong in Thailand. I used to live mm-hmm. in Thailand. And I tried to get some money out of the ATM machine around 4 a.m. And I was pretty amazed that the ATM machine said, other people who try to withdraw money at this time of the day regret it afterwards. Are you sure you want to regret?
Oh, wow. Well, that's a prime example. Yeah, that's analysis of many data points, surfacing it in a useful way to the user.
Or on that note, actually, last year I was invited and I met with Vladimir Putin, which happened to be the day after the election. And he graduated me as being the first citizen from the United States he met to the election. And I little did I know at the time, actually, that he probably knew more about the election than most other people did. And then I was dropped off at Moscow at the airport again, and I was let in the VIP lounge. They take your passport. It's all, of course, so you are secure, you know. And then I ordered a sandwich, and I found myself signing something in rubles. I hadn't needed rubles. I actually wasn't aware of the interest rate. And then my assistant said, Andreas, you spent $400 at the airport in a sandwich. Were you aware of that? So that is an example of a lack of data literacy, that I didn't know the order of magnitude. But also, it was done by the books I signed. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is, my Amex card was declined there. So I thought, gee, no, I can't even use my Amex card. You know, never leave home without it. But my MasterCard worked. So I was very grateful to MasterCard until I realized it was $400 for the sandwich. So it is about data and about literacy and inferences and helping people make better decisions. In this case, communicating with me why it was declined, of saying, are you sure that you really want to pay and then put in the US dollar amount for whatever you're ordering now? That would have empowered me to make a better decision rather than the black-white declined.
Other people who have ordered a sandwich at this place ended up spending $400 on it. Pretty valuable information, I would agree. You also talk a little bit about return on data, which, you know, return on investment. We're used to hearing a lot of other types of return, but I've never heard return on data. Explain that a little bit.
Yeah, I've never heard it either. That's why I made it up.
I love it.
For me, actually, what matters is the perceived value I get out of the data divided by the perceived work I put in or, you know, cost I have with the data.
Yeah.
For me, passively collected data like my geolocation actually has very little cost to me. In the early days of Google geolocation, it was possible to have a feed where you can display your geolocation in real time on the web. So on my website on Viking.com, at my itinerary, I had a little box which used Google Latitude and showed where I am. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was fun. So for me, that is no cost. For me, having to manually give somebody the same data I might have given them before already manually, that is a high cost, at least a high emotional cost. Mm-hmm. So up to you what your cost is. Up to you what your benefit is. But overall, you can average over people's costs and the benefits. So that is my average return on data investment. And I think it's very clear that some companies, some websites, give you just objectively a higher return on what you give to them than others. And I want that to be surfaced. Like, if you buy a car, it shows the miles per gallon you get. Or if you buy a refrigerator, it says stick on it and it tells you how energy efficient it is. I want to know how data efficient a refinery is to make the decision of whether I use this one or whether I use another one. Mm-hmm. Now, for some people, that might not be a relevant number. That's okay. If you say, whatever, you don't care for energy efficiency, then give them some other numbers. Like, for example, how secure is it? Do they use two-factor authentication? And all of these are, as you said, trade-offs.
Absolutely. Who's making that determination, by the way? Is it the company that's coming up with the score? Is it a third party that analyzes all of these companies that are handling the data? Like, how is that determined?
Yeah, so in the US, for instance, we have the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, which determines whether it's boilers or whether it's cars, what the emissions are. Mm-hmm. In Germany, we have TÜV, Technische Überwachungsverein, and they also have measures which go beyond just how safe something is to how efficient it is. Then there's this ISO norms. There are a number of organizations. They're gearing up to have measures similar to the ones which are proposed in the book to help people make better decisions.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Another, of course, of the Bill of Rights is the right to inspect. We've talked a little bit about accessing the data, inspecting the data. I mean, we've kind of touched on that a little bit. You know, kind of the safety audit information. Privacy is a resource. You talk a little bit about privacy being a resource that can be managed with something Cynthia Dwork of Microsoft Research dubbed differential policy.
Differential privacy.
Oh, sorry. Differential privacy. Sorry, that was my misreading here. What is the trade-off there?
So differential privacy is one of these wonderful crypto constructs, which actually has as a goal that I'm very happy to share data with you if for the collective it can have an advantage. But
lift all boats.
I only want to do it if I cannot have a disadvantage as an individual.
Okay.
So that is pretty cool stuff. And let me give you one simple example. If you want to learn about the health habits of a certain group of people, then let's say you want to know whether people do drugs, or you want to know whether people visit prostitutes, you know, whatever your favorite occupation is. And then you can go up to people and say, hey, you know, did you visit a prostitute last month? And people probably will say no. Or did you do drugs last month? People probably say no. So that gives you a very biased estimate. So instead, you give people a coin and they say, thank you. Oh, hold it. You need to do something with the coin. You need to flip it. If it comes up heads, then you need to say the truth of what I'm asking you. If you cut it up, it comes up tails, then you say yes, irrespective of what the truth is. So now the person flips. You don't know what the outcome was. You ask them, did you do drugs last month? Do you see a prostitute last month? Whatever you want to know. And they say, whatever the coin flip said. When the coin flip said one, they say yes, whether they did or not. If the coin says zero, then they say the truth. And so on the ensemble, in the group, you can back out what these rates are. Whereas every individual is protected by saying, yes, it could have been.
Plausible deniability.
Exactly. So that's a lengthy example, which is 30, 40 years old. But that idea that you're really smart, that you create noise at the origin, mm-hmm. and that protects the individual, is something I'm very, very much in favor of. That even if the government changes even more, that we have to worry. Even in those cases, you cannot put the individual in prison. And you know from how I start the book that my dad spent many years in prison in East Germany because the Soviet authorities thought he was an American spy. So for me, the fact that government can use data to, you know, put people behind bars mm-hmm. is one of the reasons that I worry about the government more than I worry about companies. It's probably a US-centric view. In Europe, people worry about companies more than they worry about the government.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, that's definitely one of the fears, I think, of people when they think about the scope of big data and the data that's being collected behind the scenes. That's definitely, I think, top of the list. And apparently that's an American thing to think, If the companies have all of this information, what's to stop, like, what's happening behind the scenes that keeps the government out of that information? And could they really do anything about it anyways? I mean, you know, there are also very, you know, obvious and in the news examples of how this information is being accessed, whether the company wants it to be or not.
Yeah, I actually am very, very curious what really the underlying fears are that people have about their data. And I don't know whether you have a Twitter handle here. Mine is on the screen, at A. Weigand. If somebody has an opinion, I would actually love to know what really the fears are that people have, why they want their data to not be collected or maybe to not even be created. Is it discrimination down the road? Is it... Yeah, so I actually always like to have that conversation in class, mm-hmm. and you having a much larger audience than in the class, I actually think it's a good question for people to think, what really is it that our fear is?
Well, and it might not be something specific. It might not be, I'm afraid of this one thing happening because of my data. It might be, I think, at least for myself, what I concern myself with about all this information is what I don't know of. Is the kind of the chilling effect of that is that you end up wanting to share less because you aren't sure that by sharing this thing that seems so non impactful now could eventually someday be you know, make you a target for something, or, you know, single you out in a certain way. And so, in essence, you decide not to share.
Or you can, without wanting to hurt somebody, hurt somebody. Mm-hmm. So a very sad story for me 2 weeks ago is that I was going to have a friend of mine from Beijing swing by for a few days and visit me before going to grad school here. And what I wasn't fully aware is that by putting on my WeChat, they call it Moments, like my public profile, mm-hmm. a picture of him who was not out in China, that had a disastrous effect on at least his perception of himself and his future. So sometimes you do something, you share something, you create a piece of data, yeah. which for here, you know, luckily we live in a world in the United States where being gay is not an issue anymore. And I'm very happy to see, for instance, my students that that really is not an issue for anybody anymore. But that's California.
Yeah.
And then you post something on another site and you make somebody very unhappy by having done something which you didn't intend to make him unhappy, that makes you sad. Mm-hmm. So those are things where I think we are, as Jeff Bezos would say, on day one of negotiating our social norms, of finding out what the consequences are of sharing data.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that's not an easy determination to make what's okay to share and what's
and
not, especially now
time.
Because people are sharing everything.
And it's changing over time.
Yeah, for sure.
As you know, when apparently the first gay bar in San Francisco, they had no windows, but they had wooden pens. And the reason was that people couldn't see who was inside. So transparency is very important, but we have to all take our share of making sure that it doesn't get used against the people, but that it gets used for the people. Mm-hmm. So embracing transparency, embracing diversity, I think are just very obvious values which go through the entire book.
Absolutely, I would agree. You also talk about the right to amend data. You point out that big data is so big it can't possibly all be accurate. So instead of devoting our time on making sure that only accurate information is captured, we have the right to amend it on the back end and actually go in and make corrections. Talk about that a little bit.
Yes, absolutely. That's one of the deep beliefs I have, is that in few cases only is it that the central authority can say this is how it is. Science is pretty good, but then you also see that paper get debunked by other people. Mm-hmm. So for me, being able to add to an existing data set, like think about Wikipedia, where you annotate things and then let the user pick the glasses he or she wants to see the truth through. And then maybe over time it turns out that that user handle who always says things like this turns to be debunked after a while. So you turn down the weights on that person.
Right.
Whereas that person seems to be a person who early on highlights things that will become important down the road. So you should have that seat at the controls of adding things and saying what you want to see. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem, of course, which you're probably going to say next is, but what about the filter bubble? Isn't the problem that people then will only want to see things that reinforce their values? I don't have a principled answer to that. I think that's where embracing diversity, where being open and maybe every now and then being shown things from another perspective helps. Mm-hmm. One thing The Economist wrote about a few years ago by now when I proposed it was that Facebook should have an option where I can wear another people's hat. So where I could see the world like a white supremacist sees it, just to get a feeling about how they see the world.
How
maybe it helps
that,
us a little bit. And you know, maybe we even hope that they might want to put on the hat of a person like me.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Right. Going kind of the opposite direction. Are there risks in letting go of only collecting correct data and giving people the ability to mend after the fact?
I think it's just yet another illusion that we can correct the data.
Yeah.
So there are mistakes everywhere, and it's a constant dialogue with the data, how things, you know, move on. For me, I'm a big fan of the scientific method, of doing experiments, of constantly asking new questions. And, you know, if you want to summarize, you know, really my attitude, then it's the questions first attitude, not a data first attitude. I think it's very important that we start with questions, with good questions, and not just say we'll start with the data.
Right. Formulate around that. Kind of touching on this a little bit, right to blur data, which is essentially giving the people who are giving their data to these companies the ability to tweak it after the fact, but not eliminate it entirely, right?
Yeah, so in the context of differential privacy before, we talked about whether we can insert noise at the source. Mm-hmm. That is the ideal case. But in many other cases, that is not possible. So can I insert noise later? Can I blur something? For instance, say my geolocation. If I say, well, I don't want you to know that I live in 41507 17th Street, number 12, which you can easily find on the web, so I'm not telling you any secrets you don't know, but I still want to say, just let them know that I live in the Castro. Mm-hmm. And now I'm ordering some pizza. I'm really hungry, Domino's, and that, you know, just deliver it in the Castro. I don't want the pizza man to know where I live. Just drop it off in the Castro. You know, probably not the desired effect I have. So I think people to understand the trade-offs.
Oh, yeah.
That what do you need to give? Now, for decades, we got screwed by marketing companies that pretend that they need some information for us to have a service, which simply is not the case. So calling that and telling people that you don't need to see that about me in order to give me what I want is very important. Or flipping in the positive. If you're a marketing company, make sure your user understands what the benefit for him or her is by giving you the data you're asking for. So if I enter something in the Amazon search bar, it's pretty obvious to me that I benefit from telling Amazon what I'm interested in. If I do a query refinement in Google, it's pretty obvious to me that I get more about what I want to have. But there are enough cases of people, and I hope that they will die out soon, who, because maybe their boss told them, maybe their bonus is related to it, tries to get data for me where I have no benefit. Mm-hmm. That is one of the things I'm very, very much averse.
Or not only no benefit, has a negative use case for that. I mean, I have used the Android operating system for years. They have, you know, you're given controls when you install an app. It tells you what are the privacy, you know, what are the things that this is tracking. Does it need access to your call log? Whatever. It could be a calculator app.
And the calculator must know who your friends are.
Yes.
Absolutely. I mean, how would you use a calculator that does not have access to your friends?
It's a really great question. I'm still trying to figure it out myself. But you know, I mean, that ends up being overwhelming because we encounter this all the time. You have to actually slow down a little bit, which is maybe part of the lesson when it comes to data, is not just acting so instinctively and just move, but
right.
Slow down and analyze a little bit.
But
understand.
I mean, look at this European law with the cookies. What a piece of baloney that you now need to access when you want to access any European site. They always have that cookie warning. And it's just like Pavlov reflex, that you, of course, click yes. Mm-hmm. So that's what I resent, that the lawmakers, they don't think about what it really is that they want to share with you. And then companies, okay, fine, we put on that label. And then every clicks and nothing is gained. It's just one click more for you as the user.
Right.
Have somebody like the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, or the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, they have both very smart people working for them. Have them create a few personas and then see which one you identify with most and then proxy out your choices of what you want that dating site or that calculator to know about you. Mm-hmm. So I think that is the solution, not to overwhelm the user with either a stupid button, if you want to proceed, please click here. As we said before, having me lie that I have read and accept the conditions.
Kind of just scrolled through.
Or so I think there's a lot to be gained by making it clear what people really are signing for.
Yeah, I would agree. I would completely. You also talk about the right to experiment with that data. And like you said earlier, it's not that they're getting this huge dump of data and, all right, so, you know, put some numbers in a column and see what you could do. But you're talking about the actual services offering tools to allow them to play around with that data.
Absolutely. 2 days ago, I went to a wonderful screening here. It was a film by a friend of mine from college called Baby Steps. And we had brunch yesterday. And in passing, sort of, I brought him a copy of my book, which is really nothing compared to the work that went into this film, an amazing film, Baby Steps, Bonnie Cheng. And he sort of opened the random page, and it was a description of what you can learn about other people who you might be interested in on a dating site. You can learn what age group they interact with, what race they interact with. And that is pretty interesting, how you can make better decisions based on the data you create. So that's one of the examples of right to play with the data.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then, I mean, we've kind of talked about it a little bit, but putting that much control in the hands of people is a lot to ask. But I think that really depends on how they're doing the job that they're doing on their end to create, I don't know, an easy way of accessing it, an easy way of playing around with that information. I guess the responsibility of that falls in the hands of the data refinery.
No, it falls into all of our hands. If you think about collective action, if you think about unions in the Industrial Revolution, I think they were created because for each of us individually, we had no power. Mm-hmm. Google or YouTube can happily lose your data and you have no power.
Yes.
So the question is, what can we do as a group?
Mm-hmm. And then finally, of course, and we've talked about this a little bit, but porting your data for other companies. I know Google does a pretty comprehensive job, right? Like I'm sure you're probably more familiar with this than I am, but of the big companies that are harvesting and collecting all of this data, How do they compare as far as allowing customers to port their data? I know the controls are there to a certain degree, but they're not getting rid of, they're not letting you have access to everything. And who's doing really well on this right now?
I think Google is very smart in giving you but keeping what has value.
Right.
For example, and this is maybe potentially stale. A year ago, somebody told me that if you use Google AdWords, if you use show an ad in response to a certain search term, that Google doesn't show you, if you have a portfolio of search terms, which one it is that people actually had when they clicked on your ad. Hmm. So I think it's very smart people really deeply thinking about the economics and there's not much we can do. So the way I look at it is that ideally you want to create an alignment of interests. So there, for example, with this example here, there is an alignment of interest against click fraud. Mm-hmm. Because Google is not benefited by click fraud in the long term. Because the prices, you know, they can charge will go down. Mm-hmm. You, of course, are not that interested in click fraud either. So thinking about the problems we have here with data, in this case with clicks, and framing them in a way that we have an alignment of interest as opposed to the interest being opposite. So in other words, making it a win-win situation as opposed to a win-lose situation. That's where creativity comes in, of defining a problem potentially from a new angle so both of the sides can benefit against the criminals in this case.
Mm-hmm. Are you optimistic of the direction of where this is all heading right now? I mean, you know, obviously this is a part of the greater conversation around what should be done 10, 15 years down the line. Like what is the time frame on something like this? And do you think it's going to happen the way you envision?
So maybe I'm a dystopian utopian. Or maybe a utopian dystopian. No, I think it is our responsibility to actively think as society, not just you and me, but as society, what it is that we want. And for that, we need to have a language that allows us to actually talk about that, to have that discourse. Mm-hmm. It's clear to me that we have possibilities no generation ever had before us based on the data. it's also clear to me that they are dangerous. But at least for those of us who live in democracies, I think it is our task to acknowledge the role of data and to push the organizations, legislators, the executive, to actually move in the right direction in what we believe, believing in democracy, is the right direction.
And that could be a long-term thing, but that's certainly the direction that everything's heading. So that's super important. The book is Data for the People, How to Make Our Post-Privacy Economy Work for You. It's about empowering you with your data and not feeling... I know for myself, I don't know if it's come across in some of the questions, but I feel a little overwhelmed by the data sometimes. And so this book was refreshing in the sense that, hey, you know, it's not about being powerless. It's about figuring out how to take some of that power back. And I really appreciate you coming on and talking about it today.
And I appreciate being here. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you.
And
especially coming up to the studio. I really appreciate it. Hopefully you didn't have to sacrifice the gray sky that was the solar eclipse today in the process. But Andreas Weigand, author, Data for the People, definitely check out the book and, hopefully inform yourself about data as we move into this incredibly and increasingly data-rich society even further. Thank you again.
Thank you for having me.
All right. If you want to watch all sorts of interviews, we have some great interviews as we do each and every week on Triangulation. twit.tv/triangulation or twit.tv/TRI. We record live every Monday, 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific, also 1800 UTC, if that's helpful for you. You can go to twit.tv/live to watch the live recording. All of us here at Twit do some really great interviews with some fascinating people on awesome topics such as this today. So definitely check it out. It's my honor to be here. I'm Jason Howell, and thank you for watching Triangulation. We'll see you next week. Bye, everyone. Yes, totally ties in.
I want to read that app. So I think you can have me do the voiceover.
I'm very curious.
All right. I'm on?
Yeah. Okay. You're good, right?
Yeah.
This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. The mortgage experience wasn't keeping up with the times. It was dated and it needed a client-focused technological revolution. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you are getting the right mortgage for you. It is convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. It is powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in milliseconds. Based on your income, assets, and credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for you which you qualify and find the one that's just right for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. That's rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Equaling housing lender. License all 50 states. NMLS consumer access dot number 33.
Thank you for schooling me on my ad read, sir.
I think I want that to be there. I mean, I read exactly what it said.
Yes.
No, so, awesome. Will you do that? Will you do that?
I think that's up to people that are not me.
What's that?
We've got it recorded. We will ask. I think that's awesome, man. Thank you.